I'll ask our marshal to call the next case.
Calling case number A231095, State versus Tisdale.
Counsel, you've both been here before, 15 minutes each for presentation of your case. 5 minutes is reserved for rebuttal to appellant counsel if you choose to use that. Please remember to state your name and which party you're speaking on behalf of for our recording purposes. Appellant counsel, when you're ready, go ahead and approach the podium.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And I should note, we are all aware that you did withdraw one issue from our consideration. We've received that document.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Chang Lau. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Ms. Kelly Tisdale. This court should vacate Ms. Tisdale's conviction for causing great bodily harm by distribution of a Schedule 1 or 2 drug and third-degree sale of heroin or fentanyl because the state's circumstantial evidence did not exclude the reasonable inference that the drug that caused Jade Heron's overdose was a Schedule 3 or 4 opioid. Now, I want to start this argument by summarizing some of the circumstances proved in this case that I think allows for that reasonable inference that I'm referring to. The first is that the state's evidence provided that any and all opioids, any was one of the words used by the fire captain in this case, and all was the word that was used by the investigator in this case, could have caused the overdose that Ms. Heron experienced. Now, another thing that we can conclude from this record, and the prosecutor conceded this in closing arguments, is that all opioids have the same effect. Now, the last piece I want to point out is that the state's evidence provided that Narcan has the same effect on overdoses of any and all opioids. So at this point, we look to the statutory scheme of schedule scheme here in Minnesota, and we note that there are opioids or narcotic analgesics in all four schedules. And so given it is the state's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the drug that Ms. Tisdale allegedly sold or distributed was a Schedule 1 or 2 drug, it necessarily...
You have your problems in disputing that the overdose was on heroin. So you have the female caller who is pretty evident as far as who's making a call that female had overdosed on heroin. So we have that statement. Then we have officers who respond and they find her. And then we have testimony, I can't remember who did the testimony, but we had testimony that Narcan, the effects of Narcan in remedying a problem were the same as when there was a heroin overdose. Can't we make that inference that that was sufficient to prove that there was heroin that was involved?
I don't think we can argue that the evidence was insufficient to prove the state's theory of guilt.
Okay, but under the circumstances, explain to me how that works with Narcan. That if somebody is overdosing and that is what's administered, that it doesn't do anything if it's not a scheduled drug that it's applicable to.
I think the testimony is that if it's not an opioid, and I think one of the state's witnesses testified that if it were a drug like methamphetamine, that someone were overdosing on Narcan would have no effect. But the testimony also provides that Narcan works on overdoses that are caused by any opioid. And so, again, I point out that there are opioids that are contained within any of the four schedules.
So the testimony was that it could apply to any? I didn't know this until I was reading and working up this case. So that's why I'm asking you.
No, absolutely, and I'm happy to explain, Your Honor. I didn't know this personally myself. I am not a toxicologist. I don't know, opioids to this degree. But the testimony, the record provides, and the prosecutor, again, concedes this in closing argument, that any opioid could have caused, any and all opioid could have caused the overdose that Ms. Heron experienced, and Narcan works to reverse the effects of any opioid. And the prosecutor, in closing argument, provided some examples of drugs that were not heroin or fentanyl, the drugs that were charged in the third degree charge, that could have caused the overdose, such as morphine, oxycodone, codeine, and several other, I think, Schedule 1 or 2 drugs. Nobody really talks about Schedule 3 or 4 drugs.
That helps but, me.
But, Counselor, given all that information, you still have the piece of information that Officer Holmes testified that dispatch indicated that the female 911 caller who was with your client when she was overdosing indicated that a female was having a heroin overdose. How do you get around that piece of information?
Of course, Your Honor. And so two things about that. First, I believe the female caller, and this is established by the record, was Lacey Willerton, the person who was with Ms. Heron on the night she overdosed. I think the problem with that, or not necessarily the problem, but how we get around it, as Your Honor characterizes it, is that a subjective belief of a person as to what a drug is, as to the identification of the drug, is one piece you look at to decide whether or not that is actually the identity of the drug. And I think that's established by the Supreme Court case in State versus Vail. So, I think it's separately established by...
So following that logic, that's one piece. So you have that piece, someone saying it's heroin. You have an officer coming with Narcan, administering Narcan, and reviving your client. Isn't that just another piece that bolsters the circumstantial evidence that, in fact, it was heroin? You have someone saying it was heroin. She may or may not know it is. And then you have Narcan being administered, and lo and behold, she's revived.
Yeah, I mean, again, Your Honor, our argument here is not that the evidence doesn't support the state's assertion that this drug was heroin or fentanyl, bearing in mind that the state, you know, uses those alternatives over the course of the entire trial. But the prosecutor, by his own admission, acknowledges that this drug could have been morphine, it could have been oxycodone, codeine, and I think that's supported by the record, right? I think that the prosecutor undercuts his own case by making that assertion in closing argument with regards to the third degree, the drug sale charge, right? Because he's acknowledging that even though we charge heroin or fentanyl, it could have been codeine, it could have been morphine, it could have been these other drugs. But that same logic applies.
The jury hears all of that, and of course, your suggestion that it could have been another drug besides fentanyl or heroin, I mean, the jury heard that, and it's very difficult, of course, to say that the jury got it wrong. I mean, what is the strongest alternative theory that you have that the jury could have been persuaded to have acquitted your client?
Well, I think there are sort of two things I would respond with, Your Honor. First is that the jury wasn't informed that there are, in fact, opioids in Schedule 3 and 4 drugs, right? Nobody talks about that. So the jury is not informed of the law there. That's not in the jury instructions. The defense attorney does not bring it up, neither does the prosecutor. The prosecutor talks about needing to prove that these opioids belong in Schedule 1 or 2, but he doesn't talk about the existence of opioids in the other schedules. The second piece I will note is that the case that I provided yesterday, and I do apologize for the untimely supplementation of the case, but... You know, in that case, that was an amelioration doctrine case, right? And so the jury in that case was not informed of the fact that in order to be found guilty of possession with the intent to sale marijuana, that the state needed to prove that the THC content in the alleged substance was above 0.3%. All the same, the Supreme Court reversed Loveless's conviction in that case because it looked at the evidence that was provided and it held that the state's evidence didn't prove that the substance had a THC content that was required by the statutory threshold.
Had the state established and presented testimony of what the drug was, then you wouldn't be here today.
Yeah,
I mean, that was an essential responsibility they had because of the charge.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think it's also because of the other evidence that the state presented, right? I think if this were a case where, you know, the state is alleging that my client distributed methamphetamine and caused great bodily harm, and, you know, the methamphetamine is not in Schedule 3 or 4,
but
right?
You acknowledge the Supreme Court repeatedly has said that they are not casting a bright line rule to say that
100%.
The state is burdened to test in every case and
100%.
Present
right.
that.
I think over and over, Vail itself, which we rely on significantly, says that there's not a bright line rule, testing is not required, and Olhausen provides that you can use circumstantial evidence. And Lovelace says the same exact thing.
You're not are you asking us to adopt a bright line rule
no.
and say they should have done that?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. My position here is that based
the evidence bodes with an alternative defense.
That's right. Yep. That's right. Basically, that the state opened the door to this notion that any opioid, including Schedule 3 or 4 opioids, could have caused the overdose that Ms. Heron experienced, could have been the drug, any opioid could have been the drug that was distributed. And they didn't then try to narrow it to a point where it fit within the statutory definition of the crime. They didn't try to narrow the drug to only Schedule 1 or 2. They did to some extent by having one officer testify that the only drugs he's seen in the community were Schedule 1 or 2 drugs. But the fact that a single officer has only seen those drugs in the community is not sufficient evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that that drug was a Schedule 1 or 2 drug. It does not foreclose the possibility that that drug was a Schedule 3 or 4 drug. And so given that, I do think that the state has failed to exclude the reasonable inference that the drug that was distributed and caused Ms. Heron's overdose was a Schedule 3 or 4 drug.
What else would we need in this case to get past that on a circumstantial evidence review?
Yeah.
Because it seems like any Narcan with any opioid, how do you then prove it?
Well, I think there are several ways. Looking at Lovelace, I don't think the Supreme Court really delves into that, and neither do some of these other cases that talk about the identity of the drug and applying the circumstantial evidence. Testing, obviously, would have been one way. We have no idea what happened to those drugs. The prosecutor makes some assertions about, well, she used it, and thus we couldn't test it, but there's no evidence of that in the record. And the state then says something along the lines of, well, we couldn't test her blood because she wouldn't come to the hospital with us or something, even though the state subsequently arrested her.
So that'd be
but the other evidence that you can use, potentially, is having an expert come in and testify to the prevalence of the Schedule 3 or 4 opiates, right? The record is completely silent as to how prevalent these other drugs are. And if there's only a small likelihood that these drugs are in the community, then I think that would really build the circumstantial evidence to support that the drug that was used and caused the overdose was a Schedule 1 or 2 drug. But there's no discussion of that, no evidence of that. The other piece that the state could have presented, if I were the prosecutor, is to show that it wasn't a Schedule 3 drug, because codeine, morphine, oxycodone, they're all in that Schedule 3 category, but they're in specific doses. The prosecutor could have provided testimony to show that those specific doses cannot cause an overdose. But again, the state did not do that. And so there leaves an open question of whether or not those drugs in those doses that the state, some of which the state identified in its closing argument, could have caused the overdose in those doses, which would make it a Schedule 3 drug. And so, again, I'm not saying that in all cases the state needs to provide evidence to exclude other schedules. What I'm saying is in a situation where the state provides evidence that any and all opioids can cause an overdose and any and all opioids could have been what was sold, then you have to, at that point, you're opening a door and you have to close it or narrow it to a point where it fits within the statutory definition. If you don't, then the circumstantial evidence is not sufficient to uphold a conviction. So, I mean, if the court doesn't have any further questions, I would see the remainder of my time.
Counsel, I do have one additional question. Outside of the identification of the drug, is there any other facts within the record that supports an alternative inference of guilt outside of it being that she took a scheduled 1, 2, or 3 drug? And I guess let me give you some clarification.
Yeah, sorry, Your Honor.
Ms. Wellington testified that her, Smith, the third individual went to get drugs from Tinsdale. She said it was that they were trading meth for heroin and perhaps fentanyl. Ms. Wellington indicated that they went back, they gave the drugs to the individual. She overdosed. Then there's the Narcan. Outside, those are the facts. Officers indicated that there was a call to the police. That call indicated that someone's overdosing on heroin. Police come, they give Narcan. Outside of the fact that you didn't test for it to be a drug, is there any other fact that supports an alternative theory other than she used heroin and that was what happened?
So my time is going to be
up.
Can I take the time? Okay. So I will say that there is no evidence to support to directly support or to affirmatively support our contention that this could have been a Schedule 3 or 4 drug. But that is not the applicable test, right? The circumstantial evidence provides that it is the state's burden to prove beyond reasonable doubt each element of the offense, which requires the state to exclude all reasonable inferences affirmatively with its evidence. And so the fact that there's no evidence to support our reasonable inference is not a death knell to our claim. Again, I will say that the subjective beliefs of an individual as to the identity of the drug, Loveless Vail says that is insufficient by itself. And regardless of what they thought they were going to get, they could have gotten something else. That's a distinct possibility. So I will say for all those.
Oh, thank you. You're
of
wrapping
course.
Up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was gonna remind you.
Yeah.
You'll have your
just
5 minutes for
reverse,
rebuttal.
Please.
Thank you. We'll hear from the state.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Sean McCarthy. I'm an assistant Rice County attorney. I appear today on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. I want to jump in right away with two important concepts here. The question of testing, and gee, why didn't the police just test this stuff? The victim is the one who took the substance. And the victim is the one who was offered medical treatment, medical testing. But as is really common among drug users, they don't want to go in and get tested because they know they just took drugs and they don't want to have heroin found in their system and then be criminally charged with that. It's incredibly common. So from a prosecution standpoint, the panel was asking.
All right, so I'm just curious. From a prosecution standpoint, you think she's got drugs. I mean, that's probable cause that a crime has happened. Could you get a warrant is it kind of like a DWI situation where you could get a warrant to see, in fact, if they have something in their system, or is that too intrusive?
Legally, it would be possible to explore that, but here's the dilemma. The police investigator on the scene and the charging attorney who's going to have to prosecute this case, if the person had died, if they hadn't done Narcan, this would be a murder case. This would be a death case. So the dilemma they face, and they don't know if the person's going to relapse and have it kick in again, too. It depends on how much they took, where they injected this stuff. There's a lot of factors. If you haven't ever seen this before, this is a great case. Watch the video. This person looks like they are dying, and they do this Narcan dose in the nose, takes two doses, but you watch this person come back to life. That's something, sounds like from the panel's questions, you personally haven't experienced that from your own trial court.
Back to the testing then.
Okay.
In this case, she didn't die, but if the person had died, you would certainly have tested to determine what drug resulted
then,
that.
Then so we wouldn't have needed
to find out where we have that right. Inability to do that.
We wouldn't have needed consent then in the same way that you need it now on a live person, because testing the interior of somebody's body is one of the most invasive things. I know the court is aware from the DWI context, for example, that's where some of those legal possibilities come from. But here's the other dilemmas. This is a person who potentially you want to have as a cooperating witness. This is a person who needs potentially additional medical treatment or who may need some additional help. You don't want to necessarily alienate them. But at the same time, how do we get to that? In a case like this, you don't need to. The most important thing I'd ask the panel to take away from this is as Judge Harris was just describing, it's the total picture. It's not just the one call, 911 call from a witness who said there's a female who just overdosed on heroin. It's not just the testimony of that witness and the victim and the other parties present that this was a deal. It was a drug trade. Methamphetamine for heroin was the trade that had been set up. It wasn't just the testimony of the officers. Hey, I've been doing this for 16 years. I know this community. Nobody overdoses on anything except Schedule 1. narcotic analgesics. That's Officer Burbank testified to that. He's got 16 years working in this community. The only schedule, the only narcotic analgesics, which is that's where the opioid concept comes in, that's classification. The only ones people overdose on are Schedule 1 and 2. He specifically testified to that. That's part of what the jury heard in the full picture, the total circumstances. That's what ties into what Judge Harris was getting at. I want to also touch in here with the logical consequence, or if you take appellant's argument to its logical extreme, it really boils down to conjecture. Is it hypothetically possible that the defendant got a whole bunch of cough syrup, managed to extract the codeine from the cough syrup and concentrate it into something strong enough to cause an opioid-like overdose? State would submit, or rather respondent submits in this to this court, that's unreasonable. The case law is really well developed here. Chu, Stein, these are all from pages 8 and 9 of respondent's brief. Stein, Chu, Hughes, Taylor, Asfeld, Ostrom. There's 5 cases from our Minnesota Supreme Court that have all said over and over again, the state does not have to remove all doubt. The state has to remove reasonable doubt. We'd submit that the totality of the circumstances in this case shows that appellant's theory that it might be hypothetically possible that it was something other than heroin or fentanyl, that theory is unreasonable in the totality of this particular case. The fact that drug users frequently choose not to get medical treatment and medical testing after after getting Narcan, that's a barrier for law enforcement in terms of, well, gee, it would have been nicer, it would have been cleaner if we'd had a test of this person's blood that showed heroin. But that was the same problem in Vail and the same problem last month in Loveless. Gee, it would have been nicer if we'd had more testing. Problem is, that line of cases I just cited to, most notably State versus Stein from the Supreme Court in 2010, direct quote from our Supreme Court, possibilities of innocence do not require reversal of a jury verdict so long as the evidence taken as a whole makes such theories seem unreasonable. On this case, the Tisdale case that this panel is reviewing, respondent submits that the theory that it might possibly have been a Schedule 3 or 4 substance, it might have been a whole bunch of cough syrup, it might have been a whole bunch of oxycodone tablets boiled down to what they actually have the percentage in them. And as counsel just noted, the percentages in Schedule 3 and 4 are much lower concentrations of the opioid drugs. So you'd have to have a whole bunch of those pills. This is a common sense argument here. You don't need to be a scientist for it. But if you got a pill that's got a small percentage of a opioid in it, you'd have to somehow get all that opioid out of that pill and a whole bunch of other pills, concentrate it together, and that's what the person overdosed on. Here's the best argument that I can give the panel. If that were a thing, if it were relatively reasonable, you know, relatively possible and reasonable for a drug user to take Schedule 3 and 4 substances and concentrate the opioids in such a way that you could get a really good high off of that, they would be doing it. It would be a thing. And law enforcement would know about it. People would be overdosing on it, which is what's suggested here by appellant's argument, that this was some, it's possible that it might have been a Schedule 3. If that were a thing, law enforcement would know about it, and the courts would know about it. It's not a thing. There's not a single case throughout Minnesota where that theory of facts has ever percolated to the surface. And in fact, you have in this record the direct testimony of Officer Burbank, 16-year veteran from this community. He's never seen anything except the narcotic analgesics, which are the Schedule 1 and 2 heroin and fentanyl. That's the only thing that causes this kind of overdose and this kind of response to the overdose. I have some time left here. That was the heart of what I wanted to get out, that the reasonableness component of the test that the court applies, as Judge Schmidt was asking about, hey, this is a circumstantial evidence review. The reasonableness, the reasonable doubt language concept there, Appellant's theory simply isn't reasonable on this record in the totality of the facts. If the panel has any questions, I'm happy to address them, but that really gets to the heart of it here. It's, is this reasonable or not? State would submit that it is not a reasonable theory, that the jury's verdict should be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and you'll have the last word, Mr. Lau.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start by noting that opposing counsel points to a bunch of things outside of the record, and I think it really bolsters this notion that the state could have but didn't support its theory of guilt with additional facts that it didn't actually end up producing at trial. Now, if the state had produced evidence that in order to the only concentration of the opioids in Schedule 3 were in cough syrup and in tiny pills, in order to get a high, you needed to boil it down and do all those things that opposing counsel noted, yes, that would be great evidence to provide to show that this was not a Schedule 3 drug, but that evidence isn't in the record. The state also asserts, and if so long as we're talking about evidence that's not in the record, that the only drug that you can overdose on are those in Schedule 1 or 2. That is absolutely false. That is false. In Schedule 4, there's a drug called Darcet or Darcan. It's been discontinued in Europe because how easy it is to overdose and get addicted to that drug. That's a Schedule 4 drug. That is direct in contradiction to what counsel is saying. I mean, but again, that's beside the point, right? Because none of those facts are in the record. The state has to now point to facts that are not in the record to bolster its argument that the proof was beyond a reasonable doubt, because those facts were not submitted to the jury. And they should have been. Because again, if this notion that only fentanyl or only, that's controverted by the state's own evidence, right? The experts come in, the state's experts come in, the fire captain and the police investigator come in and say any and all drugs.
Why wouldn't you consider Burbank to be an expert based on his experience? I mean, he's been around for a long time.
Perhaps expert is not the correct way to put that. But, you know, just to the state's witnesses come in and testify that any and all opioids could cause the same effect, could be reversed. The effects of them can be reversed by Narcan. And so this notion that only these two drugs could have caused the overdose, that's directly contradicted by the state's own witnesses. In fact, the state itself concedes that any and all opioids, the state uses those words in its closing argument, and then identifies specific other drugs that could have caused these overdoses, none of which opposing counsel points out. So again, you know, I want to note that, you know, this is a totality of the circumstances analysis, right? And it seems like opposing counsel is indicating that there's some, at least a abstract theoretical possibility that this could have been a Schedule 3 or 4 drug. Our assertion is that given how many holes there are here, how little evidence there is of what schedule these drugs were in and whether or not they were heroin or fentanyl, that allows for a reasonable inference. It's not unreasonable. It's a reasonable inference that, in fact, these are Schedule 3 or 4, and perhaps the Schedule 4 drug that I was just talking about, drug that caused the overdose that Ms. Heron experienced. Now, with regards to the warrant, I don't think that really matters. I mean, we're not in here claiming that the state needed to do a test.
I understand it. The victim is not who's...
Correct, Your Honor.
Who was charged. I mean, I understand that. I'm just... opioid epidemic is huge, and
absolutely,
and in some ways, if the legislative body decided we'd figure out how to solve it, I'm just kind of brainstorming.
No, I mean, the thing that bothers me about that piece is that, you know, everybody keeps talking about, well, she used it, and we can't test her because, you know, that's intrusive, you know, it would have hindered her willingness to cooperate. But there's no discussion about, well, she used it out of something. There's a container, she used it in the car. There's no investigation into, you know, looking for the packaging, looking for the thing that she used to inject herself from. There's no discussion. The state simply, in closing argument, just says, well, she used it, so we can't test it. But more often than not, you test a substance that was found in packaging. You test a substance that was found in the item that was used to inject it. And so, you know, I do think that the state perhaps had the opportunity to test here, unlike in Olhausen, right, where the defendant discarded the drugs and they couldn't find it, had the opportunity, but for whatever reason, let it go. And, you know, I think that should be put on the state. So for all those reasons, I ask for reversal of both of these convictions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The matters are submitted. A decision will be issued in 90 days, the statutory time frame.